You're hearing voices from NPR.
On our planet, there are people who play rivers as if they were drums.
The Earth sings, sounds for and from Mother Earth.
And the chickens were making the most unearthly, unchicken-like mewling sounds.
We move from New Zealand and Africa to the opposite end of the planet, Alaska.
For me, growing up hunting, we learned how to make those geese calls, and one of them is lick, 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 lick.
If you speed up recordings of elephants' voices, it reveals a new channel of communication.
The Earth Sings, from hearingvoices.com.
From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Billions of years ago, they say that the universe began with a bang, and the energy of that cataclysm still permeates the cosmos. This is the sound of our beginning.
Welcome to The Earth Sings, a Hearing Voices special celebrating sounds for and from Mother Earth. I'm Dee Mae Roberts of StoriesFirst.org. A moment before there is sound, there is silence. Some 15 billion years ago, the Big Bang sang our universe into existence, a birth cry out to the cosmos. Those sounds are now slowly ebbing to us here on Earth as microwave radiation, first recorded in 1965 by physicists Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson of Bell Laboratories. You can hear it on the CD, Pulse of the Planet, Extraordinary Sounds from the Natural World. Join us for the next hour as we travel the world with ears wide open. The Earth Sings is produced with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
I remember.
From sound outside the Earth, we move to a land where the Earth reaches out to the sky. The Annapurna Circuit is a 300-kilometer trek around the Himalayas. It reaches an altitude of 5,300 meters, touching the edge of the Tibetan Plateau. For their honeymoon, Aaron and Bronwyn Zim recorded their travels through the Annapurna Mountains.
Annapurna. Western travelers have been walking the Annapurna Circuit for years. It's a breathtaking and difficult journey through central Nepal. The Annapurna region is a landscape of 20,000-foot peaks, precipitous valleys, and no roads at all. Little power and little money penetrate the hills. Still, it is changing with every year that passes and every person who visits. My husband Aaron and I made the trek as part of our honeymoon. This is our record of Annapurna, as it was in 2001. Aaron is a sound artist. He makes field recordings when we travel. These are the sounds that he recorded while we trekked. My name is Bronwyn. I'm a journalist and a dancer. These are my memories. Trekking is its own very physical way of life. For 3 weeks, we walked up and down mountains, over rivers, and through dozens of small villages. Every day, there was nothing to do but walk. Walk and look and listen. We slept in tea houses, the small family-run hotels that cater to travelers in the hills. People ask us if trekking was hard, if traveling in general was hard. The hardest thing is remembering what you experience. Recently, Aaron asked me, what do I remember about our trek? This is what I remember. Listen. A song. I remember about 15 minutes into our trek, two little boys asking us for one pen and then for money. Then, when that failed, trying on our sunglasses and laughing at each other. One chance, they kept saying. When they asked where we were going, Aaron answered in Nepali, Bule Bule Jane, which means going to Bule Bule. And before long, it turned into a little song, and the four of us were crossing the Mars Yangdi River on a metal suspension bridge, singing Bule Bule Jane, Bule Bule Jane, Bule Bule Jane, Bule Bule Jane. A clock. I remember staying the first night in a lodge owned by a Swiss man and a Nepali woman and their two adorable daughters. In the dining room, there was a clock on the wall with these funny chimes that sounded like something out of a video game. Wandering minstrels. I remember pressing on, as Aaron likes to say, in Chamje, not stopping at the first hotel like I wanted to, but then getting rewarded by passing a house and hearing singing and sarangi playing inside. We, of course, stopped in our tracks and lingered by the door to listen. Someone saw us and gestured for us to come in. It was two men who were wandering minstrels, Gundharvas they're called, playing folk music for a dark room full of adults and children. One of the guys wore very nice leather shoes. The river. I remember the Mars Yangdi River, walking along it and sometimes over it on these narrow suspension bridges that swung and moved as you made your way across. I remember how huge and furious it was at points, and how immense some of the rocks were. The smaller ones were refrigerator-sized. The bigger ones could be whole buildings, or buses, or planes. Under one bridge, a water demon was supposed to live. Chanting. I remember hearing chanting voices coming out of a lodge alongside the trail. A woman standing by the door saw that we looked curious and invited us in. It was a dark room with a creamy, smoky smell of butter lamps. There was a table that must have had more than 100 of them burning on it, off to one side. Along one of the walls, 5 people in robes were sitting, chanting from books. I think there were 3 monks and 2 nuns. From time to time, the nuns spun drums with one hand. The drums beat themselves with tethered balls. I remember feeling completely unhinged by the heavy winds that were oppressing us along the trek through the riverbed to Jomsom. I knew I was losing it when I started playing chicken with a pack horse coming toward us on the trail. There was a slightly less well-established trail just off to the side, and I remember thinking, you know, this time the four-footer is moving for me. But I lost. I moved. A huge prayer wheel. I remember climbing lots and lots of steps, spinning lots and lots of prayer wheels as I climbed, to see a monastery in Marpa. At the top, there was an entry hall with a huge prayer wheel, probably 5 feet tall, that would ring a bell as it went around. And it kept going around because there was an old woman sitting there who was giving it an occasional spin. She was constantly murmuring mantras, and she would say namaste from time to time, as if to greet someone, but not to anyone in particular. Thank you. insects. I remember seeing lots and lots of ladybugs, some of them squished on the trail. I remember butterflies in iridescent blue. In the lower valleys, we always heard crickets and cicadas. They hummed and buzzed and made complex phasing rhythm patterns. Chickens in cages. I remember passing a little rest stop with a peepal tree and a water spigot where a bunch of porters were taking a breather. Their cargo consisted of chickens in stacked cages, and the chickens were making the most unearthly, unchicken-like mewling sounds. Tea houses. I remember the oddness of the trekker tea house relationship. The whole time we were trekking, we stayed in little tea house hotels, usually run by a single family. I always felt like I was invading the family's routine whenever I wanted something, which is odd since running a hotel is their routine. But still, I couldn't help but feel like a big old walking interruption. Bamboo. I remember a father and son dragging bamboo down the hill above Tatapani. They were dragging logs at least 10 feet long, maybe 15 feet. You could hear them coming a mile away. I remember getting up at 4:15, all for naught, to make the 40-minute hike up Poon Hill, which is supposed to offer amazing views of Annapurna I and Machu Picchu. But by the time the sun rose, all we could see was an invasion of clouds and the peaks kind of poking up above from time to time. Annapurna is a goddess, an incarnation of the goddess Lakshmi. Her name means full of grain. She's a symbol of wealth and prosperity. We found wealth in the Annapurna Hills, in the obligation to inhabit the moment, to appreciate where we were, simply walking, simply listening. But Annapurna's name is also ironic. Nepal is not wealthy. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. Since we were there, Nepal's problems have only multiplied. It's not clear how easy it will be to go back in the future. But even if we don't go back, at least we have these moments, these memories, and these sounds. It makes me happy to think that in this moment, right now, monks are chanting, yaks are sleeping, donkey bells are ringing, or prayer wheels are spinning. Annapurna, Memories and Sound, was produced by Aaron and Bronwyn Zim. Field recordings by Aaron Zim. Narration recorded at Delicate Ear in San Francisco with assistance from John Eikensier. Okay. I think that's it for now.
That's an excerpt from Annapurna. The whole story and many more luxurious field recordings are at quietamerican.org.
Whether above or below the surface of the earth, every phenomenon has its own unique signature in sound, including the lava flow of a volcano.
The 1983 eruption of Hawaii's Mount Kilauea from Pulse of the Planet, produced by Jim Metzner at pulseplanet.com. Coming up, we move from New Zealand and Africa to the opposite end of the planet, Alaska. When we return with The Earth Sings from hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You're listening to The Earth Sings, a Hearing Voices special. I'm Dee Mae Roberts of StoriesFirst.org.
On our planet, there are people who play rivers as if they were drums.
Many people respond to their environment by making music to express their feelings and to honor the world around them. In New Zealand, the Maori people communicate with each other through song story. This tradition helps them preserve their culture and their relationships to nature and their ancestors. I had a chance to visit the beautiful, unspoiled natural settings of New Zealand and immerse myself for a short time in Maori song and country. Auckland War Memorial Museum, Maori welcoming song, sung at most official events here. The Maori culture has always attracted me to this country, ever since I saw my first jade tiki pendant and heard the story behind it. Every carving, every word in their language has a story. This music calls back to ancient times, 1000 AD, when the first Maori came to Aotearoa, the long white cloud, the Maori name for New Zealand. Rotorua, land of volcanoes, geysers, and bubbling mud. Aotearoa has 21 active volcanoes and the fastest growing mountains in the world because of the tectonic plate shifting. Rotorua is also home to Maori cultural events. Kia ora means hello, goodbye, welcome, and is a blessing. I go to a Maori hangi at Tamaki Village, a performance and feast where we're greeted by tattooed warriors. And then left to wander through a forest where singers gathered around campfires until we find the concert mare, or meeting place. The music reaches and resonates deep inside, a profound experience for me. Tahi Bay, near Wellington, on the North Island. Wai is the Maori name for water. It's also the name of a music group led by Mina and Maka, who are working to preserve their language through their music. Mina gives a traditional Maori introduction to herself.
A Māori ora kia tātou katoa ko ngā puhi, ngāti kahununu oku iwi, ko Uta te whanga kingi, kei ta tūpari taonui, oku mā tūpuna, ko hana rawa ko tūrei oku mātua, ko Minaripia, aka Wai Taku Ingoa. I said my ancestors, my mother and father, and who I am.
Maka says language connects Māoris to their history and their culture.
Our government, when they first came over here, enacted a policy of assimilation in the late 1800s. And so slowly but surely, the Māori language wasn't used in commerce, it wasn't used in business, it wasn't used in everyday actions like catching the bus or going to the shop. In 1989, our government made our language official. Previous to 1989, it wasn't official, so therefore it wasn't used in anything. It's something that has been growing, and although there are still a lot of battles to be won and a lot of things to be overcome, at least it has started.
Tēnā koe, te papa e takoto nei. Tēnā koe, tēnā kōrua, tēnā kōrua, tēnā kōrua.
There are a lot of people out there who sing and do things about the retention of our language. We are not going to be a culture which lives in a museum, which sits in a glass box.
Pūpūngia te kakaho. E kore e whāte, tūtira tāua, kia kōta he.
Glen Orchy, outside of Queenstown, in the South Island. Two kinds of tourists collide here, the young, wild students on holiday and the retired leisure set. Activities are either bungee jumping or the dinner cruise. I choose something in between, a Dart River safari jet boat ride complete with daredevil driver Simon, who has conquered the laws of physics by spinning the boat around 360 degrees on a dime.
Woohoo! Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm wet.
Sorry about getting you wet, guys, but the Hamilton spin I just did is my brakes in a jet boat. It's the easiest or the fastest way to bring it to a stop. Where are we going, guys? Right up towards the mountains in the background. That's the Barrier Range, and that's home to the three glaciers that really feed the Dart, the Bride, the Whitbourne, and the Dart glaciers. The big mountain out on the right-hand side, you can see a lot of cloud going over the top of. That's Pikarakatahi, or maybe easier for you guys, Mount Earnslaw is its English name. New Zealand's 13th highest mountain, about 10,000 feet or 3,000 metres. There's quite a big landslide that ripped off about 40 years ago. The geologists went walking up there to see what had happened, and they found that there was a lot of stuff called Inanga Ponamu, milky coloured greenstone. Ponamu, greenstone. And it's the only place on the world that Inanga Ponamu is found, is up in the headwaters of the Dart Valley here. So it's very rare, very highly prized for the Māori. And that particular little section I just mentioned is a tapu area. Tapu is like a voodoo hex. So if you go in there without the right permissions, very, very bad things are going to start happening to you. So I suggest you stay clear. All right, we go, eh?
Oamaru, between Dunedin and Christchurch, South Island. The most amazing experience. I watch 100 blue penguins, 10-inch-high little birds, drift from the sea after dusk, grouped together like rafts of kelp. They fish all day in the ocean and then come in at night to feed their chicks, who are nested in an abandoned limestone quarry. Takes them the better part of the night to climb up the jagged rocks on the shore and cross the gravel road to the little wooden huts that house their babies. I stand tree still as two penguins waddle between my feet.
Tēnā koutou katoa. My name is Huru. I'm singing a song called Pōkarikariana.
Rotorua, the buried village. Huru sings me a song.
O kare kare ana, a wai o rotorua, e ti gatu koe.
I'm going to miss this country. So much landscape that feels familiar. And then you see towering fern trees and palms emerge from spectacular volcanic mountains. And you know you're not home. Life feels slower and people are so friendly. Whenever you say thank you to a Kiwi, they respond, no worries, good as gold. The theme of the country, something reassuring in that. Kia ora from Aotearoa, beautiful New Zealand. No worries, we're good as gold.
Kia ora.
More New Zealand stories are at storiesfirst.org.
The sounds of a tiny leafhopper remain hidden to us unless we amplify them.
You're listening to The Earth Sings, a Hearing Voices special. I'm Dee Mae Roberts of storiesfirst.org. The Alaskan group Bamiwa mixes Afro, Yupik, and Eskimo elements into an Arctic soul stew of song and dance. It's both traditional and contemporary, and sometimes it's not even human. Greg McVicker of the series Earth Songs visited with Bamiwa.
When we hunt geese like Canadian geese or emperor goose, growing up hunting, we learned how to make those geese calls, and one of them is lick, 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 lick. And we even just wave our arm and they come, and that's one of our trade secrets when we hunt them. We still, to this day, it's a necessity.
And then the seagull.
I can't do that one.
Yeah.
But I can go, ooh, ooh. That's seal call.
That's probably our signature call. And we use it like when we're traveling, like say we're in Copenhagen in the streets and we're like,
yep,
see somebody and they don't see you in the group, like, ooh, ooh, ooh.
Yep.
And then that's, hands down. We know who it is.
Yeah.
And we also use it. A lot of our friends and people back home use that call. Or if we do it, they know who's coming.
You want me to start?
Dancers are expressing themselves vocally as well as with their face, their arms, their neck, everything, and they're and they're just dancing, and as the song is going, we need more energy, like in Yupik dancing, and we just make calls in certain places, and it just supports that energy. So we just
a lot of call and answer too.
So we try to do that, and when we do songs like when we're performing with a band, it gives us a lot of opportunity because we want to groove, we want to dance and get down. And then when we're dancing, it just kind of, it's like an involuntary thing that happens just to make these calls. Like when we're going to make a move, get down, we're just like, or, you know, make some kind of noise.
Yeah.
Spamua, talking with Greg McVicker of Earth Songs, a series which explores native influences in modern music. Another artist he's featured is internationally known opera singer Bonnie Jo Hunt. As a young Sioux on a remote reservation, she learned how to sing, first with orchestras, then with insects.
One day, my dad and I were traveling in the car, and I heard this very strange tone. It just sounded ooh, 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 like that. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. So I asked him what it was, and he said, ah, you don't want to hear that. And he reached over and he changed the station. And he said, that's opera. And all operas are real boring. And all opera singers are great, big, fat people. So I didn't dare tell him, but I thought, boy, that's an interesting sound. And what attracted me was that I thought it would be very hard to get a voice like that. But I thought I could do it, and I was 10 then. And we lived at Fort Totten, North Dakota, Devil's Lake Sioux there. And I was scared, too, because I thought, gosh, I think I'll need a voice teacher. And there were, needless to say, no voice teachers, and there were no pianos even. I also thought I should have a piano. One morning at the breakfast table, my mother said to me, I didn't know you could sing. Why didn't you tell me that you could sing? And I said, oh, I can't. I can't. She said, yes, you can sing. You were singing in your sleep. And you hit the most beautiful high notes. They sounded just like bells. Well, that's all I needed. I raced outside to find my little friend Weasel, Weasel Norsby. And I asked her, Weasel, will you join the talent show with me? I do a lot of traveling because of our nonprofit organization. We work with children on self-improvement, so I'm out in the reservations much of the time. And I had these messages saying that Robbie Robertson said to get in touch with me. So we went in studio. He said, I want you to do whatever you feel like. And now these are crickets. So I thought, oh my goodness, I'm to accompany crickets, see? And when I heard them, I was so ashamed of myself. I was so humbled because I had not given them enough respect. Jim Wilson recorded crickets in his backyard, and he brought it into the studio and went ahead and lowered the pitch and lowered the pitch and lowered the pitch, and they sound exactly like a well-trained church choir to me. And not only that, but it sounded to me like they were singing in the 8-tone scale. And so what they started low, and then there was something like I would call in musical terms an interlude, and then another chorus part, and then an interlude, and another chorus, and they kept going higher and higher. They were saying cricket words. I kept thinking, oh, I almost can understand them. It's a nice, mellow tone. And they never went off pitch until one of the interludes where they went real crazy and they got back on again to where they were. And I know that people do not know that they're listening to crickets unless they're told that that's what that is.
Underneath you.
Bonnie Jo Hunt singing on Robbie Robertson's Music for the Native Americans. She spoke with Greg McVicker of earthsongs.net.
If you speed up recordings of elephants' voices, it reveals a new channel of communication.
If I didn't know better, I'd swear that elephant is talking to us. Well, maybe we can talk to the animals. We only could learn their language. Or as producer Jay Ellison found out, if they could learn ours.
It was, I can't even remember what year it was now, long, long time ago. We were on the grounds of where the Washoe Project was. And I'd gone up there. We were, I was thinking about going to work for him as a linguistic advisor. And so I'd had a bunch of interviews and given a little talk and, you know, all the stuff that you do in academia. And then they told me that I had free access to the ground just to wander around and watch what they were doing and what work was going on. And I walked down a gravel road that went down past two cottages where the chimps lived, when behind me I heard this, which I learned later was high arousal. It was a chimp, and he was loose. It was little Dar. And up until this point, remember, my research had all been on language acquisition of deaf infants from deaf parents. And I compared that data to the acquisition of sign language to chimps. And so Dar comes running up to me, and the first thing he does is he looks up at me with these aware eyes, penetrates into me, and he goes, "Who you?" in sign language. I stared at him a minute, and before I even realized what I was doing, I said, "My name, Ken." I gave my name sign. He goes, "Me, Dar," and gave his name sign. And at that moment, it dawned on me that this is a different species. This is not a deaf child. At that point, I was relating to the chimp as though it was a deaf child when it suddenly hit me. It's the strangest feeling I ever had. He looked at me again. This is late in the afternoon, getting close to evening, and the wind is blowing a little bit, about like this. And it's that golden magic hour, you know, when it's just real, you know, it's getting late. And he looks at me and he goes, "You, me, hide and seek." The sign for hide and seek is like this, you know, one hand goes in the other. And I did what any good researcher would do at that point. I said, "Who's that?" And he goes, "Me run, you hide." And he ran off. And he went up and over the building, up into a tree and disappeared. The wind was blowing and it was getting kind of dark, and I looked around. I wasn't sure it really happened.
Called Hide and Seek with animal trainer Ken DeCrew and music by Woodstock Percussion. It's part of Jay Allison's collection, Animals and Other Stories, at jayallison.com.
The canopy of a different rainforest, where the cries of gibbons greet the dawn.
Woo-hoo!
You've been listening to The Earth Sings, a Hearing Voices special. The collection Pulse of the Planet, Extraordinary Sounds from the Natural World, is produced by Jim Metzner and available online at pulseplanet.com. Links to all the producers whose stories you've heard are at hearingvoices.com. I'm Dee Mae Roberts of storiesfirst.org.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.